Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey there, listeners. In the past 10 episodes, we've told you the story of Steve Patterson and how Franklin Floyd's impact on his family continues to echo today. As you know from this series, there are several people in law enforcement who tried to bring Floyd to justice, who worked hard to unravel his trail of lies. This was the work of many. Some you met, like Agent Scott Lobb. Many you didn't. In this bonus episode, we're going to hear more from Mark Yancey, who prosecuted Franklin Floyd in the kidnapping case of Michael Hughes and his principal, James Davis. He has some pretty incredible memories about what went down at Floyd's trial in Oklahoma City. He'll tell us about what it was like when Floyd finally faced consequences, how law enforcement finally caught Floyd for Cheryl Camasso's murder, and what the memorial was like when they changed the name on Susie Savega's headstone to reflect her real name. I recommend listening to episodes 1 through 10 before diving into this one. He talks a lot about Franklin Floyd and his many crimes. I should also give a warning. Some of the things Mark talks about are graphic and discuss both murder and sexual abuse. My producer, Kate Mishkin, spoke with Mark Yancey.
This is Chapter 13. Mark Yancey on Floyd's trial. I want to start with your time at the U.S. Attorney's Office. Can you tell me what attracted you to that work?
When I got out of law school in 1986, I actually immediately joined the FBI as an FBI special agent, and they sent me to Oklahoma. And I was an FBI special agent and legal advisor for about 4.5 years. And I, you know, presented cases to the U.S. Attorney's Office for prosecution, worked very closely with the prosecutors. And I liked being in court. I like seeing what the prosecutors are doing. I want to do that.
And what year was this when you started with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I started with the U.S. Attorney's Office in 1991.
Okay. So 3 years later, I kind of want to take us back to that point. At this point in our story, Susie Savegas has been killed in a hit and run. Michael is put into the care of Merle and Ernest Bean. And then in September of that year, Franklin Floyd kidnapped both Michael and Principal James Davis from the elementary school and left with just Michael. What was your first touch point with the story?
Yeah, you know, this case got legs from early on, and there's just so many twists and turns and unsolved issues that it just is. Yeah, it was an honor to work on something like this, notwithstanding the fact that there's so many tragedies involved. My first touch point was with one of my former colleagues at the FBI, Joe Fitzpatrick. We had worked together as agents. And he had been assigned this case that afternoon, and he called me at home that evening. I had not heard about the kidnapping, and he explained the situation to me. And to me, initially, what he was describing is it sounded a little bit like more of a domestic type kidnapping. So I was hopeful that, you know, Michael was safe. And he explained the situation to me and wanted to know what we could do if we happened to find Franklin Floyd. For it to be a federal kidnapping and a federal offense, the victim would have to be taken across state lines in interstate commerce. So I did not think we had a viable federal kidnapping charge at that point. Mm-hmm. However, Agent Fitzpatrick explained to me that Franklin Floyd had a long criminal history and that he had taken Michael and the principal at gunpoint that day. But the next day, as we started to delve into Franklin Floyd's background, that is when I really became concerned about Michael and his well-being, because this just didn't look like a case where somebody really wanted the child. I concluded pretty quickly, based on Franklin Floyd's background, he's probably a sociopath, lacked empathy, incapable of love. So I knew he's not doing this out of love for the child. This is just another possession for him. Mm-hmm. And people can discard possessions pretty easily sometimes.
And so where was Floyd arrested? Where'd they find him?
Well, he was arrested, you know, months later. So this happened in September, arrested around Halloween. I think it was Louisville, Kentucky. And Joe Fitzpatrick thought that Franklin Floyd may try to use one of those old aliases to get some type of state credential, like a driver's license. And that's exactly how we found him. He had slipped up by trying to get an ID under one of his old aliases.
And how were you able to indict him on kidnapping charges? What had to line up for that to work?
Well, a lot had to line up. The other charges that I think we had charged five federal crimes at the time. One was kidnapping. One was using a firearm during and in relation to the kidnapping. Mm-hmm. Of course, the carjacking statute was applied because he had taken James Davis's truck at gunpoint. And we also charged a interstate transportation of stolen property, that being the truck, because we had found the truck later in Texas, mm-hmm. in the parking lot of a Wonder Bread bakery. All the charges were very straightforward, with the exception of the kidnapping. And the kidnapping was a little more problematic because, one, we didn't find Michael. Since we didn't have Michael, we had to prove that element of the crime circumstantially. So you could draw some reasonable inferences that, you know, if he left the next day on a bus from Dallas to Atlanta, Georgia, that it makes sense that he probably took Michael very quickly, knowing that police would be in Oklahoma, would be swarming, looking for that vehicle, mm-hmm. probably left the state very quickly and drove straight to Dallas, Texas, which is only about 3.5 hours from Oklahoma City, abandoned the truck there, and then, of course, took the Greyhound bus to Atlanta. So that was the theory of our case and how we established circumstantially that he had taken Michael in interstate commerce.
I wonder if you can take me back to the trial and set the stage here. Like, where's it being held? Who's representing him? Who shows up to the courthouse every day? What's this all like?
The trial actually started in April of 1995. 10 days before the Oklahoma City bombing, which actually occurred right across the street from the courthouse where we tried Franklin Floyd. We had a very senior judge assigned to the case, Judge Wayne Alley, very experienced. And the trial became a little interesting because Franklin Floyd decided to waive his right to a jury trial. And we don't know why, but I can speculate his thinking was, since this case involves a child, that a jury may not give me a fair shake because it involves a minor victim. People may be automatically biased, especially when we hadn't found Michael yet. Mm-hmm. There was another interesting twist to the case. He really wanted to represent himself. He very much wanted to be able to question witnesses and make arguments to the court. You typically can't have a lawyer and argue the case yourself. It's one or the other. Judge Alley allowed some form of hybrid representation to placate Franklin Floyd. I don't know why he did that. I can speculate that he thought that we might have outbursts in court. He was represented by Susan Otto, who is the public defender mm-hmm. in Oklahoma City at the time. I believe she still is the public defender.
And Floyd himself in the courtroom, I read that he tried to marry a witness. I understand that he was belligerent. What do you remember about all that?
He was more constrained than I thought he would be. And I think the only reason he was more constrained is because the judge allowed him to sort of blow off steam. I think that diffused the situation.
Did he ever take the stand?
He did not take the stand. He presented his defense generally through cross-examination or arguments to the court.
Who did the prosecution call as witnesses?
Ed Kamiga was my trial partner. He was lead counsel. Ed and I called a number of witnesses, as you can imagine. We started with the deputy sheriff that actually responded to the kidnapping and found James Davis had been handcuffed to a tree in the woods behind the elementary school in Choctaw, Oklahoma, in a wooded area. One of the defenses to federal kidnapping is that a parent cannot be guilty of kidnapping their child. And it's very clear in the statute. And of course, that was one of Franklin Floyd's key defenses is, I can't be guilty. I am the father of Michael Hughes. So we put on DNA evidence to disprove that he was the biological father of Michael Hughes. And of course, he countered by suggesting he was sort of the de facto father or grandfather.
Oh, man. I would think you'd pick one.
Father is actually the tact he took, which we thought was an odd tact to take because obviously he always claimed he was Sharon Marshall's father and Michael was Sharon's child. So how could you be the father of both? We had the Beans testify. Obviously, they had to identify photographs of Michael and be able to talk about, you know, dropping him off at the elementary school that morning. And of course, that they had been the foster parents and that he had been in their care.
What's your recollection of their emotional state?
Very distraught and troubled. I think they had genuinely grown to really love Michael. He'd become part of the family. Michael had really started to thrive under their care. And he had, you know, step siblings who were much older and they had grown to like him and love him as well. So I think it was very traumatic for them as well.
It seems hard to talk about everything he's done without talking about Susie Savakis. Susie Savakis, whose alias was, of course, Sharon Marshall. Did anyone talk about her in the courtroom or to what extent was she brought up?
Yeah, we talked about her a lot because to refute the fact that he was Michael's father, we had to talk a lot about Floyd's relationship with Sharon and how he basically held himself out as her father those years. So we called one of her best friends from high school to talk about that relationship. We knew he wasn't the biological father. If anything, he was Sharon's de facto stepfather. Therefore, he could not be Michael's de facto stepfather. So all of that was done to try to negate this defense that he was somehow Michael's parent. We called a number of other witnesses, Greg Higgs, who was actually Michael's biological father. We called him to the stand. Obviously, we had his DNA to confirm that he was Michael's biological father.
What was he like?
Very normal, married and had his own children and knew nothing about Michael. He did not know that he was Michael's father and had noted to us that if he would have known that there was this whole custody dispute and that Sharon had died, he would have gladly adopted Michael as his own son.
Wow. I know that his mental health issues that he struggled with came up a lot in his Florida case, and that's the reason why he's never apparently put to death. Did this come up at all in this case?
Not really. We had a psychiatric exam conducted by a local psychiatrist, Dr. Donica. He was a sociopath. Dr. Donica just told us point blank that he doubted very seriously whether Michael was alive, which we already knew. We didn't have a body, but we knew when Franklin Floyd was arrested in Louisville, Kentucky, and Michael was not there, and Floyd gave a number of different excuses, crazy excuses as to what happened to Michael. In conflicting statements, we knew that he was dead.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When was he sentenced? And what was that sentence?
It was months later. Essentially got 52-year sentence because we have federal sentencing guidelines. So he got the maximum he could get under the federal sentencing guidelines. And I think at the time he was 56. And there's no parole in the federal system. So when you get a 50-year plus sentence, it's effectively life without parole.
Something that just continues to stand out to me in this case is just how he got away with so much for so long. I mean, to not even be charged in that homicide, I understand why not. He's just a fugitive for so long. How do we explain this?
Good luck for him and bad luck for law enforcement. He was smart enough to move frequently and change names frequently, rather than just, you know, going to one area, assuming one alias and keeping it for decades. He just seemed to always stay one step ahead of the law, pick the right time to just move and flee.
So Floyd stole the principal's pickup truck in 1994 during the kidnapping. And incredibly, it was only discovered years later in the parking lot of the Wonder Bread baking factory. At what point was that found in Dallas?
That was found quite a bit later. But it was obvious that it had been parked for a long time because of how dirty it was and how there was, you know, debris underneath the truck as well. So the truck was found and interior of it, I think, was searched months and months after the truck had been repurchased by someone. The gentleman who bought it took it in for some repairs. They put it up on a lift. And that's when it was discovered that there were a number of photographs taped to the gas tank of that truck.
Can you kind of walk me through what happened after that?
Obviously, law enforcement was notified. There were some very disturbing photos that they found taped to the gas tank. We eventually were able to take custody of those and look through them. And it was pretty obvious to me and all of us when we saw those photos that these were sort of Franklin Floyd's trophies, because there was a lot of incriminating photographs, including photographs of Sharon Marshall as a little girl, inappropriate type poses. Essentially, it was child pornography, which confirmed our suspicion that he was a pedophile. And this confirmed that he had essentially been probably sexually abusing Sharon Marshall since shortly after he came into possession of her. There were photographs of her dressed and clothed as a teenager, but in very provocative type of clothing. There was also some pretty disturbing photos of a woman who was bound and gagged, and it looked to us like we had some type of victim of a crime there, which was, again, consistent with what we knew of him. And obviously, we were very concerned that we had assault victim, maybe a homicide victim, and we needed to find out who that was.
This was Cheryl Clemesso.
There were also another photo or two of women that we never identified. They did not appear to be in any type of distress, but we had concerns that these were sort of his trophies. These trophies are precious to these type of offenders and predators. I mean, these are keepsakes. I assume he was hoping he could maybe somehow get to those later. Yeah, these were Polaroids, and he was very clear not to show himself in any of them, although there was one good thumb photo in one of the photographs that the police in Florida used to their advantage to try to identify him.
So he put his thumb in the photograph, which is just a stupid. Okay. Many people often do by accident. And this happened to be a really stupid mistake for him. That's really interesting.
When we sat down with Agent Fitzpatrick about this, Agent Fitzpatrick was, I think, the office's VICAP representative. The acronym's VICAP stands for the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. And this was a system set up by the FBI to try to connect serial offenders who may travel from state to state, commit crimes of violence. So Agent Fitzpatrick immediately put these photographs into the system, asking, you know, law enforcement nationwide if anyone recognized these photos in this particular victim. And sure enough, two detectives in St. Petersburg Police Department, Bob Schock and Mark DeSario, were working a Jane Doe homicide case. They immediately recognized the clothing that the victim was wearing. They had found a body, the skeletal remains of a woman a few years earlier in St. Petersburg area. They were able to take the clothing and wash it. And when you look at the photos they uploaded and you saw the pink or the purple bikini and the striped shirt and compared it with the photos that we found, you could tell it's the exact same clothing. And they were able to identify the victim as Cheryl Clemesso. This absolutely connected the two cases. They did not have a suspect then. This immediately made Franklin Floyd a suspect since he was in custody of those photos when she's wearing the same clothes, and it was probably the very night she was murdered. She was shot one or two rounds to the head.
Did you follow the Cheryl Clemesso case in Florida?
I did. I almost got called as a witness because we convicted him first. And of course, a lot of the evidence we had was their key evidence. We shared evidence and we made a trip down to Florida to present what we had found in our case to them.
And I know that you'd asked for life in prison. How'd you react seeing him sentenced to death?
It was very satisfactory and appropriate.
If you've listened to our podcast, you know Floyd was sentenced to death, but not actually put to death. He died of old age behind bars. Next up, Kate talks to Yancey about a very special memorial service he attended for Susie Savegas.
I understand that you were at the burial service in Oklahoma. Can you tell me how that all came to be?
You know, I don't know who initiated that, but we had a ceremony in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Suzanne Savegas is buried, actually under the name Sharon Marshall. And, you know, someone thought it would be fitting to get all the family together and have the name Suzanne Savegas, her real name, on the headstone, instead of some alias that she had been living under. And that's what we did. So that was the first time we got to meet Mr. Savegas, who came down, and different family members and, you know, agents that worked on the case, friends of Sharon's who knew her in Tulsa, her high school friend from Georgia, her best friend from high school in Georgia. So, yeah, it was just a way to honor her and correct history.
Yeah, that sounds like it would have been a very heavy day.
It was heavy but fulfilling, I think, at the same time, that we could, again, put a true name to this person, sort of show to the world who she really was and that she did have a family. It was sad, but again, at the same time, I think people had a lot of the mixed emotions and were just in some ways relieved and happy that we were able to put finality to this unsolved mystery.
Thanks for listening, and thank you to Mark Yancey for taking the time. This is our last bonus episode. Many thanks to our listeners. Please spread the word about this show and tell all of your friends. Hello, John Doe is an original production by Revelations Entertainment in association with First and Last Productions. From Revelations, our executive producers are Morgan Freeman and James Younger. From First to Last, Lindsay Moreno is the executive producer. Our producing partner is Neon Hum Media. It was written and produced by Kate Mishkin. Our editor is Catherine St. Louis. She is also Neon Hum Media's executive editor. Our executive producer is Shara Morris. Our development producer is Ian Lindsay. Our associate producer is Rufaro Faith Mazarura. Sound design and mixing by Scott Somerville. Theme and original music composed by Jesse Pearlstein. Additional music came from Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. Bendel Fulton is our fact checker. Our production manager is Samantha Allison. For My Heart Media, Dylan Fagan is our executive producer. Special thanks to Adelia Rubin at Neon Hum and Carrie Lieberman and Will Pearson at iHeartMedia. I'm Todd Matthews. You can learn more about NamUs at namus.gov. The number for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's call center is 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. The National Sexual Assault Hotline from the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network is 1-800-656-4673. Okay, guys, this is the end of the show. If you didn't like it, don't do anything. But if you did like it, you make sure that you rate and review the show. It helps more people to find it and hear this wonderful story. Thanks again for listening.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.